And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
And welcome, everybody, Hands-On Apologetics. I am Gary Machuda, and you have entered to Virgin Most Powerful Radio's Apologetics Dojo.
It's great to be with you today. Hope everybody's having a great day.
It's good to be with you today, and I'm getting some sort of echo in my headphones. That's kind of weird. But anyway, welcome, and we have a great show in store for you today. As always, you know, this is Hands-On Apologetics, where we try to investigate how to explain, defend the faith, clarity, charity, and confidence. And there's just so many different areas in which we could defend the faith. There's pseudo-Christian groups like Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons and so on. There's Protestant groups, Baptists, Methodists, so on and so forth. And then there's non-Christian, God-believing groups, Hindus, Jews, Muslims. And there's also the question of evangelizing non-believers, you know, and in that regard, that's what our show is about today. It's Ken Hensley, Master Apologist Ken Hensley, is going to come on board, and we're going to continue our series. I've been really enjoying this series because it basically is a critique of atheism, just basically saying, look, if you do not believe God exists, there's certain things that necessarily follow from that lack of belief. And the question is, and this is what Ken has been exploring with us over the past few months, is, well, if you take that as your premise, how does the things that naturally follow, does that really square with what you know to be true intuitively? Does it square with how we experience the world? And and the answer is no, not at all. So Ken's going to come on board. We're going to look at the question of free will. You know, if God doesn't exist, can we have free will? And what are the implications if free will is just an illusion? So that's going to be a lot of fun. He's going to come on the other side of the other side of the break. But before that, why don't we do our shout outs? Because my notes are all messed up. I want to welcome everybody listening on radio, of course, and also those watching live on social media, such as on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Great to see you. Actually, a couple of new names there. It's great to have you on board. And also, at every program, we have our critical thinking skills, which we do a finding the fallacy, and also we meet one of the early church fathers. And, both of those are very important for defending and sharing the faith. And so, we'll get armed up with sharpening our skills, and then we'll have Ken come on the other side of the break. And by the way, if you have a question for Ken, you can always give us a call toll-free at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. And we'll possibly bring you on board, and you could talk to the great Ken Hensley. Or you could always send us your emails at questions@handsonapologetics.com. Now, you may have noticed I did not give the tease for the finding of the fallacy. What is the finding of the fallacy today? Well, it is the non sequitur fallacy. Non sequitur, for those Latinists out there, you already know that means it does not follow. So this is one of those pretty straightforward fallacies, and it's one that we encounter a lot in the field. What is the non sequitur? Well, it's basically when the conclusion does not follow logically from what precedes it. Simple as that, folks. So the argument does not produce the conclusion. The conclusion is somehow disconnected. And by the way, you know, non sequiturs are, and some of these logical fallacies as well, non sequiturs are a huge part of comedy. You know, how many times have you seen a comedy where someone will propose something and then the conclusion just is right out of left field? It doesn't make any sense. That's a non sequitur. Okay, so what is a good example of a non sequitur? Well, here's a classic example. You should stop blowing your whistle because it's snowing in Montana. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Oh, well, no, that's a non sequitur if you ever saw one. What in the world does blowing a whistle have to do with snowing in Montana, you know? But, you know, there are ones that are a little closer to reality. Certainly in the realm of defending the faith, you might hear some people argue that since there were horribly immoral popes in the past, papal infallibility must be false. And, you know, if you're not familiar with all the distinctions, that actually may seem like a cogent argument, except for the fact that immorality, which is called peccability, or being moral would be impeccable, you know, without sin, being with or without sin has nothing to do with true or false teaching. They're completely different. You could have an immoral teacher and still have correct teaching. See, they're two disconnected things. And therefore, when somebody says, well, you know, you had these three or four popes that were horribly immoral, and they were, folks, it doesn't necessarily follow, therefore, papal infallibility is false. It means papal impeccability is false, that we actually had sinful popes. And that's something that Catholics readily admit, as well as non-Catholics. So that's an example of our finding the fallacy for today, which is the non sequitur. All right, so let's jump to the Meet the Early Church Father. Today's a biggie. He's actually one of the, you know, the big three, if you're looking at the early church fathers. One of the three Cappadocian fathers, none other than St. Gregory of Nyssa, who was born sometime around AD 335, died AD 394, thereabouts. Greg of Nyssa was the younger brother to St. Basil the Great, Basil of Caesarea, born roughly about, like I said, 335, and he's the third of the three great Cappadocian fathers. Unlike Basil, however, he was not a very good administrator or leader. And unlike Gregory of Nazianzus, the other great three Cappadocian fathers, he's not particularly an attractive preacher. So you have Basil, who's the administrator. You have Gregory of Nazianzus, who's the great preacher. Well, where does Gregory of Nyssa fall in? Well, apparently he is the one who was extraordinarily gifted as a man, as a mystic, as a theologian, and as a writer. That's really where he shines. In fact, in his versatility of writings, he far surpasses the other two. Now, Gregory was educated, for the most part, by his older brother Basil. After having advanced in the church as far as a lector, you know, he's part of the minor orders, he decided on a worldly career as a teacher of rhetoric. And he was married, by the way. The other Gregory convinced him that he should retire to Basil's monastery on the Iris. And in autumn of 371, Basil, trying to consolidate his ecclesiastical authority as a metropolitan, consecrated Gregory Bishop of Nicaea, just as he was sending the other Gregory, Gregory of Nazianzus, to Sesame. Gregory of Nyssa, like Nazianzus, was consecrated rather against his own preferences, if not literally against his will, according to Jurgens of Faith Early Fathers. Nyssa, however, at least agreed to take possession of his see, and but other than that, he disappointed his brother Basil incredibly, just as much as the other Gregory of Nazianzus did as well. Basil criticized and blamed him rather constantly for a lack of firmness, political, ecclesiastical unfitness, and as a poor fiscal administrator. Gregory had furthermore to contend with considerable opposition of the Arians, the Arian heresy, who falsely accused him of the misappropriation of funds, and at the synod in Nyssa in 376 deposed him while he was absent. But when the Emperor Valens died 2 years later, Gregory was able to return back to Nyssa, and in 379 the Synod of Antioch made him visitor in the Pontius, and also on his mission he was in 380 elected Bishop of Sebaste. In 381 at Constantinople, he was outspoken in his defense of Gregory of Nazianzus, And we find him again in Constantinople to preach a funeral over the Princess Pulchra in 385. And shortly afterwards, he did the same thing for Pulchra's mother, the Empress Vasilina. He was present at the synod convened in Constantinople in 394. And then after that, we don't hear from him. So apparently he is no longer living, and that's usually the date that's given for his death, is 394. So that's our early church father for today, and a very important one. Like I said, he was one of the three Cappadocian fathers, and Gregory the Great. You have Gregory Nazianzus, and of course, today's early church father, St. Gregory of Nyssa. And yeah, Gregory of Nyssa's writings are incredibly profound. He also kind of has a lot of influence from Origen. And unfortunately, some of his writings, if they're not exactly, well, they kind of take on that hue of Originism. And so I think of the three, you know, his writings are probably less accepted in the East, just because of the fear of influence of Origen on his theology. But nevertheless, lots of great writings from him and also the other three great Cappadocian fathers. The other two, I should say. There's only three Cappadocian fathers. All right, so good stuff. The good stuff continues on the other side of the break, where we have Master Apologist Kenneth Hensley joining us, where we're going to look at the question of free will. Can a non-believer believe in free will? And what are the implications?
This is Jesse Romero.
And I'm Terry Barber.
From the Terry and Jesse Show. And we invite you to listen to the Holy Hour of Power, High Energy Catholic Radio. We're two Catholics with a PhD in common sense. We're on Monday through Friday on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
What we're going to give you is masculine Catholic teachings on the faith. You know, we say we're too inspired to be tired, we're too protected to be dejected, and we're too renewed to be subdued. Why? Because we believe in Jesus Christ and His bride, the Church. And we will take each issue of the day and show you how the Catholic Church has the answer for our culture. What we really do is bring men back into the Catholic Church, which it's about time to do. We want men to be leaders in their Catholic faith so that they can bring their family to heaven.
Our program is not right versus left, it's right versus wrong. And our program is where Catholicism and culture intersect. It's High Energy Catholic Radio.
We're going to inspire you to fall deeper in love with Jesus Christ and His bride, the Church.
The Terry and Jesse Show on the Virgin Most Powerful app.
Hi, this is Eddie Chavez, host of Jesus 911. I want to take this opportunity to let you, our listeners, know about an event being held here at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina. We will be celebrating the Feast of St. Michael the Archangel on September 28, 2019, beginning at 9 o'clock with Mass in the morning and talks to follow. Ruben Nava and myself will be speaking, so come and hear us talk about St. Michael and Our Lady. Come join us, and we'll see you there.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. And we're going to talk about non-believers. And specifically, what are the implications of non-belief? And to help us walk through those implications, we have our good friend Kenneth Hensley coming into the dojo. Kenneth is a nationally known Catholic teacher and author who, since converting to the Catholic Church in 1997, has worked extensively in the field of apologetics. He has interviewed, we've interviewed him a number of times. He's also been interviewed throughout many Catholic radio and television shows. He's a frequent speaker at conferences around the country, and he specializes in teaching on subjects such as ranging from natural Christian, Catholic apologetics, scripture, dogmatic, systematic theology, you name it, he touches on it. And also he works as online resource and pastoral care coordinator for Coming Home Network, and you can get all his great material at kennethhensley.com. And Kenneth, welcome to Hands-On Apologetics.
Hey, Gary. Good to be with you again.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed our series because the approach you take is you don't see it a lot in Catholic apologetics. You do see it mm-hmm. somewhat in Protestant apologetics, and that is that you analyze the non-believers' quote unquote theology and kind of pull out the implications to show it just doesn't square with our evidence.
Yes. Yes. And you're right. The basic approach, it's been referred to as presuppositionalism. It's just another way around. Obviously, you can begin with kind of the idea of neutrality and say, I'm going to use reason and I'm going to build an argument for God's existence. I think of, Thomas Aquinas, his five ways and whatnot, other arguments like that. This approach is the other way around. This approach is to examine the worldview of the non-believer, whatever it happens to be, and try to show the non-believer where the premises of his or her worldview lead. And with atheism, this is the approach I like to take most often with people, because someone will read a book like Richard Dawkins, The God Delusion or whatever, or they'll read Sam Harris, they'll read something like that, and they'll decide I'm an atheist, or they'll just sort of decide, hasn't science proven that nothing exists but the material world? And so they'll buy into atheism, materialism, or naturalism, or physicalism, it could be called. They'll buy into this idea that nothing exists in this universe but physical particles, matter and energy, and they won't stop to think through, well, what really are the implications of holding such a worldview? And what I try to do is perform what is referred to as an internal critique, that is, step into the person's worldview, take a look around, and critique the worldview from the inside, showing, well, if you want to be a materialist, how do you deal with this? And how do you deal with that? And how do you deal with this other thing? And given the fact that I believe that every atheist is someone created in the image and likeness of God, I think there are all sorts of things that an atheist knows, all sorts of things that an atheist knows intuitively and lives by because he is the image of God. But these are things that that do not follow logically from his stated or espoused worldview of materialism. So that's kind of the approach. And we're going through a bunch of different subjects, and today we're going to talk about another one. So,
I really appreciate that perspective, because for one thing, I think a lot of us just adopt the worldview that we just either grew up with or, mm-hmm. during a teenager, we kind of slide into it. We never really think it through it critically. So your approach, kind of forces the other person to say, from my perspective, I guess that would naturally follow.
Yeah, and the problem, the main problem that I'm trying to highlight with a total materialist worldview is that it's what you can refer to as a reductionist worldview, which simply means that it's reducing all of reality to one essential thing. It reduces all of reality to material, to particles interacting with one another according to strict physical laws, physical laws, chemical laws, and whatnot. And when you reduce all of reality to that, then there's a lot of stuff that's left hanging out that you can't explain in terms of that. And in fact, in the lesson that we're looking at today, we're going to talk about, I titled it Rock'em Sock'em Human Robots. I wonder if you remember that toy when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, the Rock'em Sock'em human the robots came out. Anyway, your hearers will understand why I titled it that, you know, soon enough. But we're talking about the issue of free will. But I want to talk about this reductionist thing for a second. I have an illustration that one of my teachers gave me, an analogy one time. He says, imagine a man who arrives at an airport. Okay, he shows up for his flight. Okay, let's say that this is Steve Ray going to his airport in Detroit, you know, to take off from one of his pilgrimage trips. And his suitcase is closed. It's firmly latched all the way around. And yet there's all kinds of stuff just sort of hanging out. Like you see the sleeve of a shirt just hanging out, in the middle of the case. Or you see a pant leg. You see a bit of sock. You see some ties or something like that. Or maybe some of his lecture notes are just sort of hanging out. So the lady behind the counter, she says, Mr. Ray, I can check your bag, but you have to get everything inside the bag. You're going to need to get everything inside the bag and latch it closed before I can check the bag. And so Steve says, okay, can I borrow a pair of scissors? Lady gives him a pair of scissors, and he just proceeds to go around the outside of his suitcase, just cutting off everything that's hanging out from the case. And once he's gone all the way around and trimmed everything away, he gives her the case. He said, okay, everything's inside my case now. And the thing is, everything is inside of his case now. It's true. But the only way that he got everything inside of his case was by cutting away everything that didn't fit, everything that was hanging out. And this is exactly what reductionist worldviews do. And this, I assert, is what a pure atheism and materialist atheism does. And that is, it claims that everything can be accounted for in terms of particles interacting with one another according to strict physical laws and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And anything that it can't account for in that way, it simply trims away and it says, well, that's an illusion. It doesn't exist. And they just call it illusion. And we've gone through some of these already. For instance, the idea that we have that seems to be universal, that human beings have a special value, an inherent value, high, equal value too, that we're equal to one another and we have high value, the consistent atheist would say, well, that's just an illusion. That's not something that can be grounded in our material, you know, our reductionist materialist worldview. Another illusion would be right and wrong. We all seem to believe intuitively that right and wrong really exist. I mean, you can watch kids arguing with each other when they're 3, 4, 5 years old, and they know when they've been treated unjustly. Someone walks up to smacks them and takes their toy away, and they complain about it. They know not simply that they're upset, but they know this is wrong, that some moral law has been violated. Well, you can't find a moral law in particles interacting with one another according to strict physical laws. So again, right and wrong end up being an illusion. And consistent atheists will admit this. It's something else you have to just trim away and say, well, it doesn't really exist because it's not something that can be accounted for in purely materialist terms.
Yeah, yeah.
We've looked at unalienable rights, the idea that people possess rights that are inherent to them. And atheists galore will fight for human rights all over the world. But again, human rights are an illusion in a consistent atheist worldview. They don't exist. We've looked at transcendent meaning. Well, there's no meaning to life in an atheist universe. It's just one huge accident. And then last time we looked at personal identity, the consciousness, self-consciousness, the idea that you have that you are somebody, the idea that I have that I am somebody. This again is simply an illusion in an atheist worldview generated by electrochemical processes taking place in a brain. In fact, Daniel Dennett, one of the most famous atheists, he says it's just a bag of tricks that your brain is playing on you. So anyway, just quickly, you and I in the sessions we've done so far, we've gone through the idea of human beings possessing inherent value. We've gone through right and wrong. We've gone through inalienable rights. We've gone through the idea that life has meaning, and we've gone through the idea that we are somebody, that consciousness is something real. And we've shown that on a purely materialist basis, all of these are like the stuff that this guy has to cut away with the scissors because they don't fit in his bag.
Yeah, of all those things, it seems to me that the most difficult pill to swallow, I imagine, would be consciousness. because it's almost like you have to admit that you yourself is a figment of your imagination. Of course, who is the you're that you're a figment of,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I said that this is a trick that a brain is playing on you. I don't even want to say your brain, because what it turns out to be is that there's this lump of tissue in a skull sitting somewhere wherever you happen to be. And that lump of tissue, in that lump of tissue, neurons are firing and electrochemical processes are taking place that are tricking you into thinking that you are somebody, that you are a person. It's hard to even say it, you know?
Yeah, because you have to say you, and you refers to a person, right?
Yeah, and then what does that do? What does that do to your thoughts, your eye? Well,
yeah,
we looked at that last month a little bit. What does that do to your plans? The idea that Gary Machuda is planning something, or that he wants something, or intends something, or hopes for something, or regrets something?
Yeah.
You know, what does it mean? You know, all of those ideas become kind of meaningless. And as I pointed out in our last meeting a month ago, there are certain materialist atheists. They're called eliminative atheists or eliminative materialists. The school of thought is eliminative materialism, in which they just face this honestly and they say things like pain, ideas, thoughts, you know, desires, intentions, dreams, all of that, they do not really exist. We need to eliminate them and realize that they don't exist at all. What exists are these electrochemical processes taking place. The rest of it, they call it folk psychology. I mean, it's common. Everybody uses these words and talks like this, but it has no meaning because these things don't really exist. Anyway, we're going to talk today about free will, which is another one that is extremely damaging. I agree with you. So far, it's consciousness that seems to get to the heart of things. And this is just another aspect of this, and that is what happens in a purely materialist universe to free will.
Actually, you even mentioned it, intentionality. You know, how do you explain intention? What is intention? You would agree with me that maybe conscious, how you explain the self is the hardest, mm-hmm. or is there another layer that's
harder? Well, I don't know if it's harder. I think all of them are impossible to explain, but it's the one that digs the deepest into me.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, almost to the point where you fumble over words. Well, hey, I hear the music. We're chatting with Master Apologist Kenneth Hensley. We're going to talk about free will and whether non-believers could believe in it and what are the implications. Stay tuned, folks. You listen to Hands-On Apologetics.
Welcome to our January 11th, 2020 Spiritual Warfare Conference. Every year without fail, this is our most popular, well-attended event. This year's Spiritual Warfare Conference will host Adam Bly, a Catholic demonologist, and an auxiliary member of the International Association of Exorcists, along with Dr. Luis Sandoval, a psychiatrist who's part of the Healing, Deliverance, and Exorcism team for the Diocese of Orange. These two gentlemen bring tons of experience and expertise in the area of spiritual warfare. This is going to be a high-information Catholic seminar. I'll be there as well, sharing some riveting stories on the diabolical and liberation found through Jesus Christ from my best-selling book, The Devil in the City of Angels. Mark your calendars, come and join us, and meet other radio hosts from Jesus 911. Contrary to popular belief, spiritual warfare is not demon-centered. It's Christ-centered. Come join us and learn how to armor up and fight the good fight of faith. Catholics, wake up. Don't hit the snooze button. Join us at St. Christopher Catholic Church, 629 South Glendora Avenue, West Covina, California, on January 11, 2020. See you then. Strength and honor in Jesus' name.
Genesis 1:27 says, God created man in his own image. Male and female he created them. According to Pope St. John the 23rd, it is not true that some human beings are by nature superior and others inferior. All human beings are equal in their natural dignity. May God help us to look upon everyone as a person created in his image and likeness, and treat everyone the same without favoritism or prejudice.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics, we are chatting with Kenneth Hensley about non-belief and the implications it has in regards to free will. And Ken, why don't you walk us through this, starting with if you do not believe God exists, what naturally follows that free will becomes problematic?
Sure. And as I launch into it, I wanted to read you one little quotation because of what we were just talking about, the problem of consciousness. Molecular biologist Francis Crick once wrote, very famous atheist, "You, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules." So there you have it from the horse's mouth. Okay, now talking about free will, first of all, I want to start with the common conception. I'll walk toward atheism. The common conception that we have of free will, which is it is so intuitive and it's so natural that this is the conception that basically everyone in the world naturally has, unless they think really hard and they think themselves into another way of looking at it. Most of us would say that we are acting freely to the degree that the choices we make are not absolutely determined by something outside our will. Okay?
Okay.
Then we would say that we're acting freely to the degree that the choice that I make is not absolutely determined by something outside my will. You know, meaning if you grab my hand and you're stronger than I am and you force my hand, you know, to grab a gun and you force my finger to pull a trigger, then I'm not free. But to the extent that I am free and I'm not being determined, to that extent we speak of our choices as being free. Philosophers refer to this as libertarian free will, this idea. And this is our common sense understanding. Again, I mean, each of us is simply aware intuitively and immediately that we are agents able to choose. You know, I can choose right now to look to the left or look to the right, you know, stand up, sit down, fight, fight, fight. I can choose to pick up there's a coffee mug right here and wiggle it around with my left hand or my right hand. I can think about apples right now, or I can think I'm talking to Gary Machuda, or no, not really. I'm going to leave and go to the bus stop, or I'm going to go down and bolt, you know, a few lanes and then come back. I can jump around all over the world, and it's a common sense intuitive awareness that I have that I am an agent and I can choose. Mm-hmm. Now, while my choices are going to be influenced by things, we all know that. And sometimes our choices are powerfully influenced. You know, let's say you love apples and you absolutely hate sushi. Well, your choice whether to eat apples or sushi for lunch is going to be strongly influenced by that. But the bottom line is you're still a free agent and you could force yourself to eat sushi against your will, or you could force yourself to eat apples against your will. So to the degree that you are an agent and you're able to choose, we say to that degree you're acting freely. And to the degree that your choice is absolutely – I'm using the word determined in a serious way. To the extent that it's determined by some force outside of you, then it's not free. So this is the view that I would say people naturally have. And atheists admit this. In fact, atheist Sam Harris – complains about the fact, and I'm quoting him now, he complains that people find this idea of libertarian free will so intuitively compelling that it's hard to even get them to think about determinism, a deterministic view of freedom, which is non-freedom, which is determinism. Another atheist philosopher of mind, John Searle, he admits that this common notion of free will is so inescapable, he says, that even if it is an illusion, we would have to live as though it's not, what he says. It's just absolutely inescapable that this is how we think about freedom. And it turns out that this is the view of freedom that arises naturally from the Christian worldview too. In fact, if I may, a short quotation from the Catechism of the Catholic Church says this: God created man a rational being, conferring on him the dignity of a person who can initiate and control his own actions. Freedom is the power, rooted in reason and will, to act or not to act, to do this or that, and so to perform deliberate actions on one's own responsibility. In other words, because God exists, not simply a material world, and since God has created us to be beings that are not simply reducible to material, there is in us the image and likeness of God. There is a spirit, there is soul, whatever we want to call it today. There's an aspect of you, Gary, that God has established you as an agent, as someone, and as someone who can choose to do this or that, someone that has the power to bring about actions that are rooted in yourself, okay? So my point so far is simply, this is what libertarian free will, and this is how you define it. The Christian worldview accepts this and teaches this, and it flows naturally from our worldview. It fits our worldview. And atheists admit that this is the view that is so common that it's basically really hard to get people to even think about a different point of view. And I like where John Searle says that it's so inescapable that even if it was an illusion, we would have to live as though it's not. And I believe he gives an illustration where he says, I mean, when the waiter comes up to me at the restaurant and asks me if I want veal or steak, I mean, you know, in the moment, I can't just say to him, well, let's see what happens, you know.
Right.
You know, so I have to choose. I have to act as though I have freedom, even if I believe freedom is an illusion. Okay. So.
Yeah. So you won't be held in suspense wondering whether or not you're going to have veal or steak. You know what you're going to have.
Well, and the whole restaurant will be held in suspense. You know, the chefs, the waiter, no one knows what's going to happen, you know.
Right.
So anyway, the question that arises is this: what happens to free will in a universe in which nothing exists but material particles interacting with one another according to strict physical laws?
Okay.
And the answer is, physical systems are deterministic by their nature. You know, I can give a lot of different illustrations, but you take a pin and you drop it on a hardwood floor, and it's going to bounce around, and it's going to land precisely where it has to land, given all the physical parameters at play. You know, if there's some wind resistance in the room, something else, you know, if a cat comes by and knocks it, whatever, it's going to land exactly where it has to land. Physical systems are deterministic. If you fire a bottle rocket into the sky, it's going to go exactly where it has to go. It's not free. It's not going to take off and go where it wants to go or where you want it to go. It's going to go where it has to go, given all the physical conditions at play. And so physical systems are by their nature deterministic. Right. The internal combustion engine, it does what it has to do. Things do what they have to do. You drop something, it goes where it has to go. Everyone knows this. Now, sometimes, I mean, scientists will talk about indeterminism, and they'll talk about the fact that when you look at things at the atomic level, it appears that particles, rather than moving where they have to move, sometimes they appear to move randomly. And all I'll say at this point is this: okay, well, if it's determinism, it kills free will. And if it's randomness, it also kills free will. Either way you look at it, you don't have freedom. And so here's the problem. If the materialist universe is one massive determinist machine doing what it has to do, and if you and I are nothing more than parts of this gigantic, massive materialist machine, then we also are machines, and what we do is also determined by physical processes. And the logical implication then is, for an atheist, a consistent atheist materialist must say that free will is an illusion, is another one of these illusions, like right and wrong, like moral law, like intrinsic value, like like inherent human rights, that it's just another one of these illusions. And I always like to make these lessons tight. And so I very quickly want to say that this is something that atheist philosophers agree with. So this is not me, the Catholic, the Christian, trying to force atheism into a corner. This is something atheists agree with. Again, philosopher of mine, John Searle, this is what he writes. We are inclined to say that since nature consists of particles and their relations with each other, and since everything can be accounted for in terms of those particles and their relations, there is simply no room for freedom of will.
Okay, so someone could in the future develop a mathematical formula that would explain why I took a sip of Coca-Cola instead of, brush my hair or something like that.
Yeah, or someone, more than a mathematical formula, it would probably be someone could input all of the relevant factors, billions of factors from your past and your life and the physical situation, and could say, he's drinking Coke, he's going to drink Coke. And it would be absolutely determined. It would be absolutely determined by these prior factors. In fact, one more fun quote. This is from probably the most popular atheist writing right now, Sam Harris. He says this, human thought and behavior, okay, what you're thinking and what you're doing, human thought and behavior are determined by prior states of the universe and its laws. We are driven by chance and necessity, just as a marionette is set dancing on its strings. So if you imagine a marionette on its strings, and I move my hand up and down like this and wiggle it around and the marionette starts dancing. I know no one can see me, but I'm doing a really cool dance right now that only Gary can see. But
oh, no, social media sees it as well. That's one of the bonuses of Facebook and YouTube.
Okay.
Oh. So just FYI.
Okay. So, just like a marionette set dancing on its strings, this is exactly the situation for us. And Sam Harris includes our thoughts. I mean, so, you know, dig into this. Think about this a little bit. What he's saying as a consistent materialist is that everything Gary Machuda thinks and everything he does is absolutely determined by prior states of the universe and its laws. He is a marionette dancing on his strings, always thinking exactly what he must think, saying what he must say, doing what he must do from top to bottom. The conclusion is inescapable. Okay, we'll come back. I hear the music.
Yeah, well, you're right. The conclusion is inescapable. There can't be free will. We're talking with Kenneth Hensley about free will and non-belief. Stay tuned, folks. A lot more to come on the other side of the break.
Ernesto from Long Beach.
You know, I just wanted to comment, you know, and I just wanted to thank you guys. And I kind of wanted to encourage people that are listening, maybe that are not donating, you know, because honestly, I got to be honest, I used to think you guys were a little
too over the top,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You
That's
know,
right.
If God gave us a lot, you know, and I have the blessing of listening to all this, I just want to call all the people, you know, I got 5 kids, you know, and I don't make a lot of money, and I'm still donating to you guys.
God bless you, brother. You're amazing.
We have to do this. We have to do the extra. And it's not even the extra. People see it like it's extra. Kneeling for communion, saying your rosary, saying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. It is not extra. It's what the church tells us to do.
Amen. You're a good man, brother.
30 years old, 29 years old. 5 kids, and I thank you guys. But everybody else, man, get on fire. Fight for the truth, man. I know what I'm telling you guys. There's
I
so
love it.
Out there.
In 1 Corinthians 13:13, St. Paul says, "So there abide faith, hope, and love, these three." According to St. Ignatius of Antioch, faith is the beginning and love is the end. And God is the two of them brought into unity. Then comes everything else that makes up a Christian. May God grant that we may attain all the virtues that make for authentic followers of His Son.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics, and we're chatting with Ken Hensley about non-belief and the non-existence of free will. If God doesn't exist, then it necessarily follows that free will is just an illusion, because we're essentially just bio-machines that are working according to the machinery of the universe, you know, how we're programmed. And I can't wait to unpack the implications, because there's huge implications for this. But before we begin, though, I was thinking, you know, they threw in this idea of chance as if, you know, there's chance elements that kind of break through this, like, hardcore deterministic stuff. But that doesn't really get them out of the determinism, does it? Because even if something by chance happens, it happened by predetermined laws, and its effects are predetermined by laws. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I would say that what they're saying is that on the atomic level, it appears that particles move randomly or can move randomly. But so the answer would be, maybe if they knew more about it, they would realize that it's not really random. Something is causing everything to happen. So it's all determinism. But even if it was moving randomly, like even if it were possible that particles just move for no reason in one direction or the other and all that, it doesn't help you. Because if the choices I make, I mean, if the choice, if I go to the grocery store, if the choice I make of what to buy is determined mechanically, or if the choices I make are just absolutely random and I'm just grabbing things off the shelf without even knowing what I'm grabbing, it still doesn't get me anywhere that is meaningful. It doesn't get me to freedom. It doesn't get me. So no, the will is absolutely determined in an atheist materialist worldview. And I've quoted a couple of atheists to the effect that they agree with that. They agree that everything that we do is determined. And so it does get us to some interesting implications, and they're kind of funny in a way. The first implication is this: why talk about it? That's the question that comes to me first. If John Searle, the philosopher of mind, believes this, if Sam Harris believes this, why is he writing books about it?
Yeah.
I mean, why talk about it? If you just told me that every thought you have, Sam Harris, is absolutely determined by prior states of the universe and the laws of and physical laws, and you're a marionette jumping on your strings, then why are you writing a book about it?
Yeah.
Because you have to say what you're saying. You have to believe what you believe, and you have to, I guess you have to write the book too. or maybe you would just say, look, even if everything is determined and therefore there's no reason to write a book, I still have to live, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, I mean, even as atheism is predetermined, to write an atheistic book. But what's the purpose of writing a book if you can't persuade people, because everyone's predetermined whether or not they're going to believe what you wrote?
Yeah, that's right. Those who believe in God have to. Those who don't believe in God have to. And I guess if someone converts from not believing in God to believing in God, then that's mechanistic as well and mechanical.
Yeah.
So but what's the point? I mean, why say anything? Why debate? Why do anything? But the more meaningful implication is the one that deals with moral accountability. Mm-hmm. Because again, we all know, and we've known this from the time we were children, we all know that that you can't be held morally accountable for something that was absolutely determined that you couldn't not do.
Yeah.
You can't be held morally, you know, like I can't hold you morally accountable when you become sick and throw up, you know. A thing that happens and that it happens deterministically, you know, we don't use moral terms. And again, our atheist friends look at this, you know, with a clear eye and admit it. Sam Harris is the most bold on this, who's written a lot about the absence of free will. In fact, he brings up Ted Bundy. You remember the famous criminal Ted Bundy who had murdered and tortured and murdered in about 30 different women and was finally caught. He says in his writings and in his YouTube, you know, in his debates and talks, he says that Ted Bundy had no more choice as to whether or not he was going to kidnap, torture, and murder young women. No more choice in that than a rattlesnake has to bite someone who steps on it, you know, walking down the path.
Wow.
He says Ted Bundy was simply doing what he had to do, and therefore it just doesn't make any sense to throw around moralistic terms like evil or guilty or to say he was morally wrong. Instead, he says this is who Ted Bundy is, and he needs to be locked up in the same way that you would lock up a rattlesnake that is, you know, crawling through the neighborhood biting people. That's it. So he's not morally accountable, and if you imprison him, it's only because you need to protect people. So anyway, as I thought this through, I have this funny scenario that popped into my mind that I'll give you, and then you can comment on it. But I was thinking, okay, if you really hold this position consistently, then I'm trying to imagine Sam Harris as Ted Bundy's defense attorney during the trial for having kidnapped and tortured and murdered all these girls. And I'm thinking that Sam Harris might have said something like this. Let's say the trial has concluded, concluding statements have been made, and Sam Harris is giving the conclusion to his concluding statements, and he says this. He says, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, as you move from the courtroom now to deliberations, I ask you to keep a few scientific facts in mind. First, I want you to remember that my client is nothing more than a marionette dancing on his strings. Given prior states of the universe and the laws of nature, my client, Ted Bundy, only did what he had to do. Whether he was driven by chance or by necessity, he had no choice in whether he was going to kidnap, torture, and murder young women. Now, the second thing I want you to keep in mind is this. When you go back into the deliberation room, the 12 of you are also nothing more than marionettes dancing on your strings. And the decisions you come to are going to be absolutely determined by prior states of the universe and the laws of nature, particles and their relations with one another. In fact, now he turns to address the judge and he says, in fact, Your Honor, once the verdict has come down and you pass sentence, I urge you to remember, and this is a scientific fact, that you are nothing more than a marionette dancing on your strings, that the sentence you pass on my client is going to be absolutely determined by prior states of the universe, by particles and their relations with one another and whatnot. In short, Your Honor, everything taking place in these proceedings will be absolutely determined, mechanically determined as the movement of pistons in a combustion engine by the massive material machine within which we are nothing more than cogs. I am a cog, my client is a cog, the 12 jurors are cogs, and you, Your Honor, are a cog. Therefore, in the light of this scientific reality, I need to ask you, how is it possible for my client to obtain a fair hearing?
Yeah, that, I love that ending. That was the answer is you can. I mean, you know, I love your scenario because if you really push it to its logical ends, even though they believe everything that exists is material, you ultimately end up with the opposite era of idealism, that really everything is more or less a dream and nothing's material, because everything is predetermined, from the laws on the books against murder and torture and all the other stuff to the jury doing what they're doing. There's really no difference between everything's material and everything's just a kind of dream.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way to put it. That really is. That's Yeah.
It's just as inconsequential, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, and so when it comes to evangelism, though, I guess, you know, I will say in conclusion, as I know that the music starts in a minute or two, right?
A couple of minutes.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. That again, the situation I believe that the atheist finds himself in is that he has been created by God. He is more than material. He is more than what you called a biological machine of some sort, a biochemical machine. He is more than that because God has made him in his image and likeness. He's a person. He is a living spirit, a soul. And because of that, and having been made in God's image, all of these truths are etched into his very being. I mean, he knows intuitively, he knows that moral law really exists, that there is right and wrong. He knows that human beings have a special value and that they have equal value and high value. He knows that. He knows that people have rights, that rights are inherent, and that, you know, and so when he reads, you know, endowed by our Creator with an unalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, even if he doesn't believe in God, he thinks, yes, we have these rights. You know, he believes and he lives as though life had meaning. He lives as though his children, his wife, his friends were somebody, that they were people. He lives as though, you know, he has choices, and that people are to be held morally accountable. And for what Ted Bundy did, he had to be held morally accountable, that he was wrong. So it's like the atheist naturally believes all these things that flow naturally from a Christian worldview,
yeah,
and make perfect sense within a Christian, within a theistic worldview, and are true within a theistic Christian Catholic worldview, but don't follow at all from the worldview that he wants to insist is true.
Yeah.
And so he's caught. And my version of evangelism with him is to very kindly and lovingly try to lead an atheist to see the conundrum that he's caught in.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that causes a kind of cognitive dissonance, you know, that it's like, well, hold on a second, you're right, I can't explain this, you know, and it is kind of incoherent if you push it to its natural conclusion. So so that gives kind of a gravity to the theistic worldview that, yeah, at least if you want to think coherently and it naturally follows from, you know, how we live and so on, we should adopt the theistic worldview.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's sort of like seeing another version of this would be to see a miracle. If someone who says he's an atheist and Jesus just walks into the room and starts to talk to him, then he would be rattled because there's this cognitive dissonance, to use the term you just used. He was saying to himself, nothing exists but the material world, and everything happens by strict laws of physical laws, chemical laws. But now a miracle occurs, and so it could rattle him to think, maybe my worldview is wrong. Well, yeah. this is what I'm saying, is that these are all things he has to face then, and that can rattle him and realize, you know what, maybe my worldview is wrong, because these are all things I believe in and I live as though they were true. I have to admit that. I just can't account for any of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. Well, Ken, where can people go to get all your writings and stuff?
Oh, well, if they want to get recorded talks, they need to go to KennethHensley.com and look on the store page. Otherwise, I work for the Coming Home Network. I'm there all week long helping people become Catholic, and a lot of things I write are available on their website.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
God bless, and see you next month.
All right. Ken Hensley, ladies and gentlemen. And, wow, boy, this is the fastest hour on Catholic Talk Radio, I tell you. It's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center, turn off the dojo lights here. Coming up next, High Impact Catholic Talk with Terry and Justin. Oh, I wish everybody would have a great day. Talk to you guys tomorrow.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.